This is a production of Cornell University.
Can you give me a second?
Also, in the meantime, we did have some surveys. The organizational behavior class in ILR is studying the essay, a bunch of sections in their class, and we just decided to do that. If you could just collect those when you're done filling it out, and then we'll come back.
Okay. Alex? Block?
Here.
Breeden?
Present.
Brown?
Here.
Sopa?
Here.
Desai?
Here.
Francisco?
Here.
Adam Gitlin?
Here.
Ross Gitlin?
Here.
Goldberg?
Here.
Gurjani?
Yes.
Hoffman?
Here.
Kay?
Here.
Lee?
Here.
Meller?
Yeah, here.
Mueller?
Here.
Muir? Nicoletti?
Nicoletti is running late at the end.
Yeah. Pinky?
Here.
Patel?
Here.
Rath?
Here.
Rao?
Yes.
Gelfo?
Here.
Zulman?
Here.
Trefison?
Here.
Wolford?
Here.
Gitarian?
Here.
Santangelo?
Here.
Ravret?
Hold on.
That's all.
Great. So now we're moving on to the approval of the March 5th, 2012 meeting minutes. Are there any motions on the floor?
Motion to approve.
All right, there's been a motion to approve. Is there a second?
Second.
All right, is there any dissent? Seeing none, the approval, the March 5th, 2012 meeting minutes have been approved. Moving on to our third section, open microphone. If there's anyone in the audience that is here and is not on our schedule or would like to make an announcement, please do so now.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, just step up and talk. Just drag my chair along. Okay. So it's something that I've been kind of discussing in campus welfare, but I think it's better suited if I get your help on this as well. And this issue deals with the course evaluations. So every semester we submit course evaluations regarding how much, I guess, how satisfied we were with classes, how satisfied we were with professors, that sort. The problem is that we don't exactly know what happens with those surveys from a student's perspective. I searched basically 2.5 hours, and I was able to find it, but I feel that we should make that kind of information readily accessible to students. So I was hoping, I'm trying to push for something along the lines of either aggregating that information or providing those links to those destinations so that students can access those. That's about it.
Sure. I'm actually on a committee that looks at all of when professors are up for promotion,
they look at the scans of...
Exactly. And they are not accessible to students for a particular reason, because certain courses that are taught by multiple professors might have a stereotype or some sort of belief that it would be easier with different professors. And those reviews are kept confidential and only used for the purposes of promotion or for a professor to get tenure. So students don't have access to that unless you are on a review board for a particular professor.
Can you repeat that? Sorry. I didn't catch the reason. Like, I know you said the reason, but I couldn't follow initially.
Sure. So when a class is taught to two or more different professors,
yes.
Students might believe that a class might be
skewed in terms of one professor
exactly.
over another.
Especially with either grading or other terms, but in fact different professors teach different styles, and that can be, those questions you can direct at your individual colleges or schools registrar, and your registrar would be able to answer those questions as to how that professor teaches that class with what type of teaching style. And then those are questions that the registrar has access to, all of those evaluations, and he or she might be able to help you choose the professor that would be able to best suit your needs, but you need to go talk to your school or your college's registrar in order to find those, to find that out. But you will never be given access to the individual responses by students.
I mean, like, in terms of the comments, I'm not, well, it's something that we discussed on campus well, so the comments is something that's going to be typically biased. Those who actually take the time to fill the comments are typically negative. What we're aiming to get is, I guess, the bubble.
That's actually not true. It's usually the other way around.
The other way around.
Yes.
Okay. 10 more seconds.
So,
okay.
If you want, you can email me for more information. My MEVID is PJS264.
PJS264.
Yes. And okay. I can further answer your questions or direct you to further resources.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for coming back, David Akba, about this big collaboration so we can all get on the same page. I think a lot of us take on this similar initiative and people have left their blocks on there and we can all work together and go further than we all would get separately. I think it's really helpful.
Yeah, I'm definitely glad I found out about that.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So thanks for coming.
Thank you.
All right. Next on open microphone, we have 1 minute today. So Jay
is just going to talk about the comments because he has to leave, so he just wants to say his own two cents before
we talk about it.
We will
be adjusting today, though, as
resolutions. Give him a minute. Andrew and I attempted to comment today, and we did a study on the strength of opinion. We found that while support for increasing the length of a bank student break and the number of days off in the spring was the very opposite, but only 36% of the students found the property changes to finance favorably, and only 22% of the students actually want the senior week to be shorter. Using multiple regression analysis, we found that support for changing finance lessened from freshmen to seniors. Also, pre-med students were 70% more likely to oppose the changes to finances than their peers, while corporate and AAP seemed more likely to support the final changes than their peers in arts and sciences. We picked up a lot of the other little trends, but too many to list here. Before our study, why not perfect highlights the diversity of the campus opinion and hopefully will be the first step in actively engaging the undergraduate population in discussions like this. To fully understand the opinions from campus and to get better data, we believe more input from the student body is needed. We hope that the essay will investigate the need to engage more students in this discussion so we can bring the results to the challenging community.
Great. And so they just presented their findings, and we'll be talking more about Caltrate later today. Moving on to announcements and reports. The first is the environmental update by Alyssa Dixon and Representative
Kick. Hi. So my name is Alyssa Dixon. I'm the sustainability intern in the Department of Energy and Sustainability, and I just wanted to come and give you an update on Resolution 50, which was passed last spring, requiring students to have composting at all of their events on campus. So passing that resolution was a great first step towards getting composting readily accessible on campus. And I was on the orientation steering committee last year for August, and we did our first pilot program of event composting there. And that was very successful and led to the creation of two drop-off locations on campus. So students can bring compost to a bin behind Willard Strait and one behind Mandible, like right behind Man, and drop off their compost, and those get checked every day and picked up. So right now, a big part of that is the infrastructure is kind of in place, but we're working on educating more students about the fact that these exist and trying to implement event composting across a broader spectrum of events. So we've created a sustainable events planning guide, which you all have in your packets. So I would encourage you to check them out and share them with people. They're going to be distributed across the listserv to all the student groups and hopefully get more word out that these compost drop-off locations exist and there are a lot of other ways to plan sustainable events. We've also added two questions to the UUP process regarding sustainability. So there's a general, how are you going to make your event more sustainable question, in addition to, under the food section, how are you going to implement composting in that section. So my office is looking at those questions and kind of taking into account the responses that people have and trying to see how we can implement better education strategies around that. And then really fast, there's an event next Friday that you should all come to called Spring Fest on April 20th. It's like our Earth Day fun celebration, and I have punch cards for everyone. And if you bring your reusable mug to any of the dining facilities or don't take a bag at the Cornell store, you get a punch, and then you can bring it to the event and win a prize.
We've been working really hard for months,
2 months,
on this event, so please come. It'll be really fun and a great way to show that FA is, you know, excited about environmental initiatives.
Yeah, so send that to me, and we'll be sure to send it out and send us out a reminder on our list.
And everyone take a look, if you haven't already, take a look at the guide that is in everyone's report, a supplement that everyone's attending.
All right. Sorry, this is
a
combo. We have a lot on our agenda today. This is a by Representative
Stockwell.
I'm Melissa.
You all have a minute and a half.
That's nice. So everybody knows, yesterday the University Assembly passed Resolution 7. We did a really good job summarizing it in the email that we sent out to all undergraduates.
Thank you, Ari.
Melissa is just going to talk a little bit about the amendments that were made.
So yeah, you guys saw the original resolution, so I thought it might be beneficial to kind of say what the major amendments were made before the resolution passed, and two of them were, or one of them was to make sure that the Assembly of the UA had some input into the changes to policy 6.4. So the amendment or the new like be it resolved clause says the Assembly will be given the opportunity to robustly participate in their view of and commenting on any resulting changes to policy 6.4. Another amendment was to more like education efforts, and so that reads the university or be resolved that the university continues to increase its prevention and education efforts to make all members of the Cornell community aware of what constitutes sexual harassment, sexual violence, and what the individual rights and responsibilities are concerning them. So, yeah, for a brief summary, look at the event, that's enough. But,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so great job. I guess just to summarize, make sure that the student voice is still representative, whether the policy changes happen in our code or in policy 6.4. Mm-hmm. And Alex, for the next year, and I were going to sit down and write a message to President's voice as well, but emphasizing the role that we think students need to have in the student voice.
Perfect.
And I'm sure that the university assembly would endorse it in some way if you wanted to. Yeah.
That's perfect.
One more update before we get to some of our new business. A C4 update by Representatives Trefison and Gershon.
All right. So C4, Cornell Parent Community Celebration, with all most of you know at this point, is the FA's, I guess, meshly event to increase mental health awareness on campus. This year, we decided to reimagine the event a little bit, make it a little more formal, a little bit more informal, a little more relaxed. So we pushed that to take it outside onto Hope Plaza. We decided to include performers 3 hours of our labs. So we have a DJ, Chris 2.0 radio, coming for half an hour, and we're in the process of preparing a jazz band for the other half hour, which is 12 to 1 when you're allowed to play music on Hope Plaza. We have roughly I'd say a little over 22 organizations signed up, ranging from Big Red Bike to the Duke Tri Council to AAAS and CAPSU to Cornell Men's Matter, obviously. And then we're also partnering with the Interactive Health Fair, and which is another health fair put on by PUHC and partner organizations, and they're going to have their kids with there as well. So it's going to be hopefully close to 30 little groups on Hope Plaza, and some live, I guess, entertainment, giveaways, free food for a little while. Again, it is on April 17th from 12 to 3. It went out in the email to all students, so hopefully all students get it.
And since this is the one really big programmatic event that FA puts on, you are all expected to be there for at least an hour.
Okay, so just to add to that, tonight I'm going to send out a as we're done, I'll send out an email with details from the link to the Facebook and the code so you can invite all your friends in one go. Please do it. That's it. Thank you.
Great. Okay, great. So we're going to move on to some of our new business. First, before we get to the SAFC Executive Board, we're going to go to the Cornell Cinema Request Resolution 43 for ticket price increase by Eric Korn and Mary Sutton. Eric, is this with you?
Yep.
Okay, great. All right, so you guys have 2 minutes to present.
So the documents that you can look at are in the back two pages of the packet, and I'll just open it up for Eric to just go over it. But basically, kind of as a second part of the byline funding process, based on what we agreed with Cinema when we didn't increase their byline funding allocation and kept it at $10, was that they should be increasing ticket prices on undergraduates who are actually going to place the burden of funding the cinema on people who are actually attending the cinema rather than all students. And so in vain of that promise we made to the cinema, they're coming to ask for our official permission to raise the ticket price from $4.50 to $5.50 for undergraduate students. Now, Eric, take it.
That's about it. We're also raising all of the other ticket prices by $1 so that we can continue the quality program that we have throughout the whole year. We're going to try this rather than rely so heavily on the SA funding.
And just kind of as a point of information, graduate students also did not increase the bond funding allocation of the cinema, and their ticket price is being increased $1 as well, but it is 50 cents less than the undergraduates because the undergraduates reduced their allocation 2 years ago, and so that's where that 50-cent discrepancy comes into play. And then on the final sheet, you'll see a comparison between the movie theaters in town ticket prices and the Cornell Cinema ticket prices. Procedurally, this needs a majority to pass because this is simply just express approval by the SA.
Right, and to add on that, basically during our byline funding cycle, the appropriations committee came to the decision, which we approved, to give this as the new pricing for Cornell Cinema in their byline funding cycle. They said to us that they were going to they were going to add to their prices, and we gave basically approval that we would do this. This is just formality that we approve it. So first on the speaker list is Representative Desai.
So thank you for coming to speak with us. I guess this is the rest of the assembly. For those of you who weren't here when we did appropriations 2 years ago, like when we cut funding and the funding that we stipulated this year, like there was a very strong understanding that Cornell Cinema, like we encouraged them to increase ticket prices to make up for certain provisions that were lacking in their budget. I think it would be very ill-advised for us not to allow them to increase ticket prices now after that was a suggestion that the Appropriations Committee made only a few months ago, so I would strongly support the passing of this resolution.
Call the question.
Okay. We're going to call the question in a second. Is there any consent?
Is there a motion to move it to the debate?
It's already
to
report.
It's All right, so seeing that we're going to move to a vote, all those in favor of passing the recommendation, please raise your hands. All those opposed, and all those that abstain. All right, I have a 22-0-0. The second is passed. Eric, thanks for coming, and thanks for working with us today.
Thank you, guys.
All right, so now we're moving on we're going back to section 5, the Student Assembly Finance Commission, SAFC Executive Board. The team is presenting to us right now about changes that are regarding all of SAFC funding for the next year. It should be pretty interesting, and we've been working on this for a while, so if you guys will come up. Are you all here?
Larry's completely in the elevator, but can we put this up, the presentation up here?
Yeah.
Is that all possible?
So,
I got it.
Yeah. Okay, great. So for everyone in the audience that are waiting for their resolution, this is probably going to take about 30 to 45 minutes of discussion, and we'll make sure that we get to the calendar to yeah.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Guys,
25
minutes for that, and then we're
going to
have questions.
Awesome. We'll try and be fast then.
Great.
Hi everyone, my name is Larry Kogos. I am one of the SFC co-chairs for Neil Desai, who you all know. Brandon Coulter is the other co-chair as well. And Dan Greener, who's our VP for Public Relations. So, basically we're here to talk about our new funding recommendations for the upcoming year. So we're going to go through kind of a brief history of what the problem has been in the past, talk about our solution for the problem, talk about some of the recommendations we have for things like documentation, and then go from there. So basically, as you all know, SAC PAFs have been going lower and lower. And this has been for a few reasons. Number one, number of new groups every semester has been increasing. We've had 70 new groups brought to 2011 alone. every semester, the amount requested has been increasing as well, and the second chance policy that has worked well that we've implemented together this year allowed groups to bring in documentation, but again has resulted in the cap being lowered significantly, almost in cutting half. So obviously, impact of these low caps, many groups have been crippled. We've had countless emails from groups saying they can't hold practices, can't have events, and really our revenue stream in terms of filing funding has only been increased by a little bit. So that alone is not going to be enough to fix the issue. And the biggest problem is this is not a strategic allocation of funds, because every group can get the same no matter what they do, how much they spend. And then, so one other problem that I'd like to highlight as well is unspent funds. So after we allocate funds to groups, the group don't actually have to spend their funds. And what happens is that about 20%, sometimes even more, of this funding goes unspent. Because as of right now, groups have absolutely no incentive to actually spend their funds. Moreover, there's extensive documentation requirements. Obviously, the SAC process is a little convoluted, and that really just makes the process very difficult for everyone, including us and presidents and treasurers.
And then just to clarify one thing, when we talk about the problem of caps decreasing, we want to very specifically delineate that we're not saying that the problem is that every group should be getting $5,000 a semester, because the reality of it is that that's not feasible, and that's not necessarily what the SAFC wants. What we want is that the groups that only need $2,000 get $2,000 budgets and don't have thousands of dollars going unspent, which could have been going to larger groups.
Right. Absolutely. So our solution is a tier system. So basically the way this would work is that all organizations are placed into a tier based on their spending history. So we'll be looking at the past 3 years of data, essentially six semesters, and placing them into a tier. So those numbers that you see up there are kind of hypothetical numbers for now, but basically those would represent every semester's tier cap. So every organization would know at the beginning of the semester, I'm in a certain tier, and they would know the range of caps they would be in. So hopefully this would be a more strategic allocation, that in the sense that groups that actually need the most money can get the most money. Hopefully this would reduce rollover, and I'll talk about the incentives as to why a little bit later. Hopefully this would reduce the funding amount requested. Again, this ties in with the incentives we'll talk about later. And again, this kind of ties more to the continuity aspect of it, in the sense that groups were kind of blindsided this year because caps were cut in half. So hopefully this will be a lot smoother process from year to year. Some of the cons of this tier system is that it does limit newer groups. We have a proposed solution that we'll talk about later for this. And again, it might lead to some more appeals, because this semester we've had zero appeals. It could lead to some more appeals later on, and I'll discuss why. So basically, I'll go through this very quickly in terms of initial tier placement. So basically, we have data from the past 3 years, and what we'll be doing is ranking groups in terms of how much they actually spent over the past six semesters, and basically getting a number there, and then delineating between those groups and kind of drawing the lines to place them into tiers. So basically, the lines will be drawn at those numbers up there, and groups will be placed in those tiers. That being said, this is not going to be a static process, and groups will be able to move from tier to tier.
So really quickly, a quick note on initial tier placement. If you guys see what Larry talked about, we're looking at past spending and putting them into a tier that, you know, will then have a new cap. No group will be placed in a tier in which their new tier cap will be lower than their average spending over the last couple of years. So if a group is at average spending of, you know, $2,600, they'll be in a tier cap that will hypothetically have maybe $3,000. So no group will be limited by this system. The way that still helps us is if, you know, we're giving them a $3,000 cap instead of a $5,000 cap, we can give that $2,000 to a bigger group.
So now I'm going to talk about kind of how you move in between tiers. And basically, this is important because there are two important criteria we're going to look at when we're evaluating this. So the first one is, I'll give an example later which will help clarify. So the first is tier spending percentage, which is the amount that a group spends of their tier. And then the second number is their efficiency spending percentage, which is kind of what they spend of what actually gives them. So an example will help illustrate. So kind of assume that a group has a tier cap of $3,000. So from the efficiency spending percentage, if we only give them $2,500 and they spend $2,000, their efficiency spending percentage is 80%. And tier spending, you can see up there, that's what they spent of their actual tier cap, 67%.
If you guys want to follow along, the diagram Larry's about to do is on pages 2 and 3 of the guide in front of you.
Yeah. So now I'm going to talk about how we use these two numbers to determine whether a group moves down or up. So basically, the first layer in this determination is going to be the efficiency spending percentage, or whether groups actually spend what we give them. So if a group does not spend at least 85% of what we give them, they move down a tier. And again, these determinations are at the end of every year. If they do spend higher than 85% in both semesters, then we kind of look at the second layer, which is the tier spending percentage. So basically, from the tier spending percentage standpoint, if they spend less than 90% in both semesters, it kind of shows that they're fine in their current tier, then they stay in the same tier. But if they spend more, it's a signal to us that they should be moved up. So then that group would then move up a tier. So basically, groups will not be hurt. If a group applies for $0 and gets $0, that's fine. They stay in the same tier.
And kind of the rationale behind that was, you know, keeping club sports in mind, particularly groups that basically only spend money in one semester. You know, if you're a fall sport, you don't spend any money in the spring. You don't need that tier spending in both semesters in order to be eligible to move up. You just have to be efficient with your spending.
So now to talk about kind of tier one, this notion of a performance tier. So basically, for the highest tier, we're going to use slightly different criteria. So you still have to be eligible to move up based on the efficiency and tier spending, but we're going to be looking at other things as well. So groups that are in tier two, when want to move to tier one, have to submit what's called an annual performance report, and the SAC will look at this report and kind of determine, based on membership, awards, honors, all those things you can see up there, whether they should actually be placed into the performance tier. And these groups are hopefully going to be the ones that really have events that contribute the most to Cornell's campus. Yeah, Alice, so for the next year, our proposal, no one will be put into tier one. Every group will be, the highest tier will be tier two for now. And then the year after that, hopefully we can start evaluating groups and moving them into the performance tier. So one kind of thing that's been brought up is what happens if a speaker cancels, or if a group can all go to a tournament because of inclement weather. So we kind of decided to put in this special cancellation request, where basically a group can apply, can submit this form, and kind of discuss their unforeseen circumstances, and then the SAC will evaluate whether these are legitimate unforeseen circumstances, and then that will be used for the group's benefit so that we don't use that for the tier spending or efficiency spending calculations.
The rationale behind the 2 weeks was just so that we don't have, you know, basically every single group trying to submit these at the end of the semester, trying to basically validate, you know, why they didn't spend as much money as they needed to spend to move up a tier or stay in the same tier or whatever it may be.
So one other, really, you want to comment on this? This is your idea.
Sure. So the fast track advancement, basically, you know, we were worried about the notion of, you know, groups feeling like they got stuck in the bottom tier, or like especially new groups would have to come in, and you know, they'd come in at tier six, and kind of the worry that it would take them, you know, a very long time to become like a full standing group on campus. So the fast track advancement is basically rewarding groups that are started well and maintain early success. So you don't have to be a new group, but anytime you are a group in tier six, if you have 3 consecutive years of upwards tier movement, so you are eligible to move up 3 years in a row. After that 3rd year, you'll move up 2 tiers instead of 1. So basically what this means is if you're a freshman and you come on campus and you start a club your freshman year,
by your senior year with the fast track advancing, you could be in the highest non-performance tier and eligible for, you know, a pretty substantial amount of money. So this is basically just a way, you know, to catch groups and make sure that, you know, if you do have a bad year or something like that, you can come back to the upper levels.
Right. And this is just, again, it's just addressing concerns. Some people were concerned that if you start a new group, you're a bit limited. Yeah, you're limited at first, but you have the opportunity to not be limited towards the end of your time here at Cornell. So moving on to appealing this performance tier, organizations will be able to appeal an SAC decision to the SA Appropriations Committee and then the Student Assembly if they're unhappy with the SAC's determination of whether they should move up to or remain in a performance tier.
Same way that normal SAC appeals are done.
Yeah. This is in addition to any regular budget appeals that organizations may have.
I guess just on that note, we should have mentioned this earlier, but no group will be allowed to appeal either initial tier placement or movement between non-performance tiers, because there's no real subjective, you know, perspective that's going into that. It's purely based on a formula. It's 100% objective and calculated, so there's nothing to really appeal there.
Right. So moving on to special projects now. So basically the status quo will remain. It's really for unforeseen events, such as a sports team making it to a national championship. And basically, as is now, a group can apply only up to their tier cap for additional funding. There are really no changes there. So moving on to documentation, so this is actually one of the big changes. So basically, the reason that documentation has been such an integral part of the SAC is that it's served as a check on groups, and now that we have this tier system to serve as a check, we can get rid of a lot of this documentation, so which will hopefully add transparency to the process and make it a lot easier. So basically, we're getting rid of all documentation except for three documents, and this will be the letter of intent, the proof of publication, and the proof of travel event, because we still feel that these are all necessary. But everything else in terms of room reservations, things like that, we would like to get rid of, just to make the process a lot easier for presidents and treasurers. Other documentation changes, like I said, proof of travel distance is not required. We're getting rid of some caps, such as a chalk cap of $55. We decided that it would kind of be better for groups to decide whether they should spend all that money on chalk or copies. Groups should really have the choice to do that. And all groups will have, if you have a speaker performer, you have to submit a letter of intent.
So really quick on the documentation before we move on, I guess the rationale there for you guys, under the current SAFC guidelines, the incentive for a group is to apply for as much money as possible, to qualify for as much money as possible, and then you have it in your account. You know, if you want to spend it during the year, you can. Otherwise, you don't have to. Under the tiered system, the incentive is to be as efficient with your money as possible, so you want to apply for exactly as much as you need. Otherwise, if money goes unspent, you're going to be moving down tiers. So that's kind of why we're able to now make the documentation requirements a little bit more lax, because groups are only going to be able to get reimbursed for the receipts they turn in, so we think they'll be more accurate in their actual applications.
Yeah. So just one kind of other thing to add. So we'll actually be going back to semester budgets, it looks like, for the following year. We try annual budgets. It didn't really go well. It kind of confused everyone. And we kind of think that with the tier system coming into place, hopefully it would just be too complicated from the annual standpoint. But in summary, in terms of the tier system, hopefully this will solve the instability in caps for the foreseeable future. It gives groups the opportunity to plan ahead and really have that continuity from year to year. Hopefully, getting rid of so many documentation requirements, it's going to be a lot easier for groups to apply, so groups can actually learn about this new tier system. And I think, you know, we discussed a lot of this with SA Exec, and really I think that the key will be communicating this to groups. And the way that we'll do that, hopefully through a video of some sort, kind of going through this process and getting these changes out as early as possible, so that groups, treasurers, and presidents have the summer to look at this and really learn how the new system will affect their group and what incentives their group really has to act. But at the end of the day, hopefully this will encourage more impactful events on Cornell's campus, and we'll be able to start seeing those big events that have been cut back because of budget cuts in the past. So I'm behind it. I'm very, very proud of the system, and hopefully you guys will see the benefits of it. And I think at this point, we'll be happy to answer any questions you have.
So that was a lot of information that was just presented, but this is very important. This is basically revolutionizing the SASC and their role in funding, as well as how every organization on campus, about over 800 of them, get their funding. So this is a pretty big deal, and I just wanted to thank you guys before we open up questions for all of your very hard work on this. This is really a change that needed to happen for a while, and thank you for taking the initiative and putting the time into it. So, no, this is new business, and we won't be voting on this today, so try not to move it to business of the day. So this is only questions right now. We want to have a chance before we vote on this to make sure that all students know about the changes, as well as are able to comment with the FASC before we pass everything. Included in that is just talking about the budget as well, and some administrative, I guess, procedures that we're going to have to finish up with before we can pass this, hopefully next week. So please, I expect a robust discussion on some of these questions. It's a big packet, so.
Yeah, so on that note, if you guys are kind of confused by, like, I know there's a lot of pages in front of you, there are three main things that you have. You have a copy of this presentation. You have a funding guide that is a draft that we will be giving to groups on how to understand the process. You can flip through that if you have questions yourselves. And then the guideline changes are what you're technically voting on. So that's where you should specifically be looking for things like wording. If you have amendments, you're making amendments to the guidelines, not to the PowerPoint, which is things like that. And if you have questions about where things are in the guidelines, like, those are great things to ask us now, so we can help you find that in the next week.
The
guidelines are like a separate, like the 9-point whatever. Yeah.
So even before the PowerPoint presentation is the first thing in our class.
Yeah.
After the presentation. The first on the speakers list is Vice President of Public Relations, Gerson.
Cool. So I obviously thought it would be rather exactly and I agree with a lot of it. Just looking at this, one thing came to mind is what happens when a group is put into performance tier and then they're not performing as well?
Yeah. So if you look at the specifications for performance tiers, at the end of the year, all groups that are eligible to either move into or be in a performance tier are evaluated, which includes groups that are currently in them. So if you move into a performance tier at the end of that year, you're going to get reevaluated, and if you don't continue to meet the criteria, then you get bumped down to the highest non-performance tier.
So we're going to go one-on-one from anyone in the audience that has a question, as well as anyone on the assembly. So we're moving on to the Moshe show.
Hello.
Moshe.
Thanks, Dave.
Yeah, come up. Scroll on
up. All right.
Say your name in here for the record.
1.6.8. A real quick question. I feel like in this tiered system, people might be incentivized to spend more than they really need to get over that 90%, so they can consider for a higher cap for the next semester, because I assume every club would want to have the highest cap possible. So how would you be able to discern whether clubs really do need to go up in a tier, or they're really just trying to spend over 90%?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and we've had that in mind, because yes, at first it seems like clubs have the incentive to just spend as much money as they can. But that being said, if you're looking at the SAC guidelines, there are still very specific things that clubs can spend their money on. So clubs can't just start buying food or things like that. There are very specific things that fall under the guidelines that we would allow. That being said, is it possible that some groups would increase their spending as a whole? Yes, it's possible, but we think out of the
close to 500 booths, we think that, realistically speaking, that is not going to be too much of an issue. I don't know.
Although the more money you apply for, you're essentially exposing yourself to, you know, hurting yourself from an efficiency standpoint, because, you know, if you do, if you're a group that, you know, traditionally applies for $1,500 to $2,000, and all of a sudden one semester it spikes up to $3,000, you know, it is the onus is on the group to spend $3,000 that semester on stuff that is essential to the group's purpose. Now, Larry was touching on before, this isn't very public information if you're not like a treasurer or president, but like how it actually works is we only provide the actual funds on either a reimbursement basis, so you come in and show us a physical receipt that it is something we funded you for as an essay, or there's a direct payment method where the your account, the comptroller will actually make the direct payment out for you. So there are a lot of controls in place to make sure money is being spent on the correct thing. But again, the more money you apply for, you really have to spend that amount of money. And you know, that's difficult to do if you're aren't in the right place with what you're spending your money on.
Now, do I have time to say something? So that's pretty important.
But I think like this is actually one of the most critical questions with the new system. This is something that we talked about a lot. I think something really important to point out is, you know, the differentiation between funding requirements and documentation requirements. Just because documentation requirements are getting more lax doesn't mean we're funding more items. It just means they have to turn in less paperwork. But, you know, still, like Larry said, the requirements are very, very stringent. And in essence, like, anything that falls into one of these categories, you know, a practice on campus or bringing a speaker or going to an event, like, those are things we want to fund. So at the end of the day, if we're encouraging groups to spend more money on the things we want to fund, then that's a good thing.
Thank you.
Next on the
speaker's
list is Representative Block.
Great. So, you know, great job, guys. You guys pretty much hit this out of the ballpark. I did have one question and then one issue. The first question I have is, if we're going to move to a semesterly budget, why is it that we decided that you can move up here only at the end of the year, and why not, you know, during the middle, during the winter break? And I guess the other issue I just want to raise is the special projects fund. Because basically you bring up this idea, like, the sports team makes it to a national championship and we give them extra money. But I'm a little confused why you can only apply for it if you have room in your tier cap. You know, for instance, we know that sports groups will max out their tier cap immediately. So it basically precludes any club sport from going into the special projects fund because of that. You know, like, they wouldn't be able to use that. So I guess I'm just wondering why for a special projects fund, which is exactly for unforeseen things where you need to spend more than you should be using, why is it that you can't use it if you've already reached your cap?
So I'll take the first question, then Larry and Brandon can take the second. For why we're evaluating at the end of the year, the first thing is that, you know, it is very, like, we don't want groups moving every semester because it makes it more volatile. And, you know, every semester, like, I have a new cap. It provides kind of ill transitioning between treasurers and presidents. Moreover, though, it gets back to the thing I talked about earlier with there are a lot of groups which only spend money one semester a year. And we want to make sure that those groups aren't getting penalized. So that's specifically why the tier spending only has to be met in one of two semesters, but efficiency has to be met in both. But if we did it on a semester by semester basis, you would have to be hitting tier every time to move up, and, you know, we don't think that's fair.
So in terms of special projects, so basically the way we envision it is that if you're a club sports team, just go back to your example, and you know there's a possibility of you making it to nationals, you should leave room in your budget when you apply. And if you know there's a possibility, and you know you can project your expenses, you apply for what you need and you know you need, you still have the opportunity to apply if you have room in your tier cap for things like nationals. And the reason that we drew that line was that you kind of have to draw the line somewhere. I mean, I think our job is to control spending, and if we tell every group that they can apply for more than their tier cap, every single group will apply for more than their tier cap. And then we'll kind of have the problem of, well, now how do we allocate this money now? So I think that, yes, the onus is on treasurers to plan this and understand this, but that kind of ties back to what I was talking about earlier in terms of the education standpoint and the communication standpoint to groups.
Just one more point, and I guess special projects in the performance tier, which a lot of the clubs that would be applying for making these national conferences would probably be in the performance tier anyway. And I think special projects would work differently in the performance tier because there is no defined task necessarily. So you have more flexibility with those really prominent top sports teams as well.
I guess I'm just saying that I don't think any group wouldn't claim money. Like, obviously, if you're going to be spending the money, most club sports will be reaching the max every year. There's no reason why they would wait. You know, they wouldn't claim all the money that they can. So,
I guess that's how it works right now. Like, you know, the club, even last year or 2 years ago, when we had, you know, $5,000 caps each semester, like the club basketball team, if they spend all $5,000 over the course of the year on practices and, you know, tournaments earlier on in the semester, if the end of the year rolled around and they wanted special projects, you know, to go to the nationals, if they had already reached their $5,000 semester cap, we wouldn't give them more than that. So it works the exact same way here.
Okay. I just think that, you know, with special projects, it's already subjective. Like, we already have the ability to say yes or no. Are we going to allocate them the money? So sure, every group can apply, but we still have the power to give it to the groups that actually need it. So I just don't think that we necessarily need to limit it to when.
So we're going to move on, and remember that because this is a big...
Can I motion to extend?
What?
Can I motion to extend?
Yeah. But just because this is new business, please keep your comments and questions.
Yes. So just a quick address on that. So special projects are not really subjective. What the group has to show is that the expense was unforeseen, but as the guidelines are written, we approve the expense automatically. So we're not deciding whether this is a good expense or a bad expense. We just approve it. If a group says, we did not know about this, then we approve it if we have money.
So just to highlight, what you're talking about is, you know, the fundamental operation of how special projects works, and our guidelines aren't touching that at all. I think we spent the exact meeting. But, you know, the ability for special projects, as it exists now with our recommendation, is, you know, you can only go to your path. You can't, you know, request special projects into infinity. We're not limiting anything with this proposal. We're just taking it from the annual cap that exists now, which is $5,500. So every group, regardless of how much you spend in a year, even if it's $200, you are eligible for $5,300 in special projects. We're just carrying that from an annual cap to your tier cap. So all of a sudden, the $5,500 becomes whatever respective tier you fall into.
Okay, great. So next on the speaker list is Nisha.
Yeah. So my main concern related to what you said, the tier system, if a new group, if a freshman started a new group, he would only be able to reach the higher here in the senior year. I think, like, this could be a big concern to the innovation and originality of new groups, because if I'm a freshman and or I'm a junior and I have a really good innovative idea, maybe something new and it's really popular and everything, but I know that I will only receive very little funding. It will take 3-4 years for me to have enough funding to actually cater my needs. It really like be discouraging. It would maybe make people join other bigger groups that already have the bigger, you know, more funding. And so I think even though there's a fast track, and even with the fast track it takes a few years to move to the highest tier, I think there should be maybe a model for certain groups if they're really popular, if they have maybe hundreds of members, they have a lot of potential, a special way to apply to one of the highest tiers directly, maybe 1 or 2 semesters. It's a really special innovative and new club.
So again, like, if, you know, if you or another assembly member would like to introduce an amendment to that to the guidelines next week, you know, I'd be happy to help you write that. The reason why we didn't include something like that, so to start off, if you notice, the lowest tier cap for this semester is $1,000 per semester, which is $2,000 a year, which is actually greater than what groups get right now in their original year. Currently, under the SASC guidelines, first year groups are capped annually at $1,500. So we're actually making it easier for new groups to get started. And then over time, you know, like, it's like under the current system without any tiers, the semester caps were, you know, between around $2,700. You would be surpassing that in your second year, at the end of your second year. So really the question to us is, like, you know,
if you are a new group, then you should have to wait a couple of years to receive the maximum levels of funding that other groups, you know, some of which have been around for over 100 years are doing.
So the other issue that this presents is just simply, yeah, what you're talking about, a proven track record. So kind of what you're talking about is, you know, having only one or two semesters of proven spending. That's awesome. That's great. If you have a treasurer who does it, you know, two semesters in a row, this opens the door for organizations who, you know, do it more than one semester or whatever, to advance, but without a proven track record. So for 1 year, they're really good, and the next year, you know, they don't spend as much, so they don't apply correctly. They're going to be almost unjustly advanced in front of groups that will be doing the traditional track. So that's the only issue we saw with that.
Okay, yeah, so as you know, maybe we can because I mean, even if there are some groups that have existed for 100 years, I don't think certain groups, I don't know, like the school club attract, you know, maybe hundreds of members as maybe a new, you know, if there is a new, you know, if a new student is a very popular thing that attracts hundreds of members, that could benefit more the general community than a new class in 100 years. But yeah, we can talk about that later. All right.
Next
one
is speaker,
hi, I'm ready. So thanks for coming today. My question for you is about the movement between tiers, and I'm wondering if you guys have considered doing sort of like a non-linear movement where clubs can maybe move between tiers 1 and 5 at a much more rapid pace than just one a year, other than just through that special process if they've been moving up one per year. And I think that would really help sort of like new clubs and sort of that they could maybe start at a higher tier, but also give that same chance to current existing clubs?
I mean, so yes, we considered it, mm-hmm. And I think the reason we were against it is this notion of the proven track record. We've kind of found that the groups that really have the most impact are the ones that have that track record of spending. And the question is kind of also thrown back, like, where do you draw the line? So why is it fair for one group to move up, but not fair for another group to move up? We didn't want this to be a totally subjective process because then I think in that case the SAC would have too much power to delineate between what's a good group, what's a bad group. You know, if you're the squirrel club, that's great. It's not my place to say whether you're a bad club or not. I think it is my place to say whether are you spending the money that we're giving you and are you spending it well.
So, yeah, essentially what Larry's talking about is everything before you get to the performance tiers, being, you know, tier one or tier two when you're applying to get in tier one, those placements and those movements before are completely objective, you know, based on these numbers. It's strictly black and white. There is really no appeals process because it's all in the numbers in our spreadsheets, you know, how much you applied for, how much you're spending, and, you know, are you budgeting correctly? And so, you know, opening up what you're suggesting, you know, inherently is a great idea, but like you said, if we take every case, 472 undergraduate student organizations on an individual basis and add in that gray area, that subjectivity, that gets very political. Again, it's beyond the scope of what we're trying to do as an organization, and apart from anything else, it would, you know, fall on the SA to hear a lot of appeals on an annual basis.
Well, what I meant was that couldn't, like, the formula be expanded to include sort of movement between maybe, like, two tiers rather than one? Because I think you can still keep sort of, like, a formula using similar criteria, but just have the advancement. Like, let's say they use all their money allocated in that tier, and they might...
We already have a high requirement at 90%. Mm-hmm. Just one other point I was trying to make to address both these concerns is that all the groups that have applied essentially are going to be placed in Tier 5 as the lowest tier. And they have a cap of $2,000 per semester, which is not much lower than what we had this year. So it's not like caps are being cut across the board. In fact, they're going up for most groups.
All right. So we're going to keep these questions a bit shorter because you all are going to be coming up next week, too, and we have a lot more to get on our agenda.
These are all great questions.
Thank you for answering them so thoroughly. Next one is
Nada.
Do you want to?
Yeah, so I had a question, like, when are we going to be...
You can say your first and last.
My name is Nada Severance. I'll be in SA next year, but, and I'm representing Women's History Center. My question was, you guys sent out this PowerPoint 45 minutes before the meeting, and there's a lot of, I mean, as soon as it was sent out, I had a lot of emails from minority groups that had a lot of concerns about, like, how their budget is going to be affected, because a lot of time minority groups are the ones that don't ask for that much money, or so I hear. I really couldn't get any statistics because, obviously, we had this 45 minutes before the meeting. I had 5 minutes to talk to people before I came in, and a lot of them had big concerns, so I was going to ask, like, are we going to be bringing this back to the next meeting and having more questions for the discussion, because there is a lot of concerns with that, and I really can't even tell you what it is, yeah. Because...
So what just happened is every... This is the first release of all of the information. So they're coming for the next day. This is only a new business, so we're asking questions, initial questions. There will be a week long before they come back, and that's when we start having third discussions on what people have concerns with, what kind of resolutions or amendments they want to see to the guidelines. Mm-hmm. So... Yeah, and we can extend it for 2 weeks. I think that would be very acceptable, especially as we're all getting feedback together, however your timetable works. Mm-hmm. But to start getting that information from all different types of students is really important right now, right? Why are we doing this PR question?
Yeah, a lot of the minority groups have, big concerns with it. Like, it sounds great overall, but if you start looking at the little details, their numbers, it can cause great problems.
Right, and also, what's your email? Can you give them...
So it's email sasc@cornell.edu.
Okay.
We read all those. We'll be reading all those very thoroughly over the next week. So please send us anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
And also tell them to come to that thing. Yeah. I mean, a lot of them wanted to be here, but they will listen out 45 minutes, so nobody could be here.
Right. Yeah. So that's why we have to be multiple times.
And I also recommend speaking. From your national, and channeling sort of that information and coming to them so they can help represent the community.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the speaker list is Vice President of Finance, Nick Light.
All right. Well, thank you guys. A few things I just wanted to address. Again, I brought up in e-board price quotes. So just kind of a background for everyone. Price quotes was one of the major pieces of documentation that was very burdensome to student groups, and the FDIC recommended pulling out. I would advocate that it be included in the requirements just because you're expecting these treasurers to do price quotes anyway before to make sure that their budget is efficient and obviously they're not over-requesting. And so by asking them to turn in price quotes, you're building in the safeguard that they actually will be asking for what they need versus a treasurer that doesn't expect to do a price quote, it doesn't say you have to do it, putting in random numbers, and then that screwing them up later on. It kind of safeguards them and make sure that they're following this process that they should be following. Because based on the incentive structure, you already expect them to submit a price quote anyway. So it shouldn't be that much more burdensome. But again, I want to be more conservative in this round, and I'm interested to hear what you guys think.
I guess documentation is always one of the biggest points of contention on a semester-by-semester basis, because groups view it as obstacles or hurdles that they have to jump in order to get the funding that they feel they deserve. So, like we said before, our general sentiment is, we've kind of structured this system to hold treasurers accountable and, to be as accurate and, as... morally just in what they're asking for, on a semester-to-semester basis, so they can, do well from a tier standpoint, from an efficiency standpoint. So I guess our general sentiment is the less documentation, the better. And we kind of cut the fat off everything that we think is almost a waste of time. So that's just kind of how we say it. I understand what you're saying. You're trying to, combat the idea of, treasurers overlooking it or overseeing it, or you're trying to skip errors, asking for as much money as possible. It's great. I don't need a price. My base false cost $100 a piece, blah, 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 blah. But we're hoping that, if we publicize this well enough and the intricacies of tier movement are, as public information as possible, treasurers will inherently avoid doing it.
That being said, I think we're still open to discussing this, and you know, tomorrow I know we're meeting. I'd be happy to talk about this. I see your point. You know, like Brandon said, we do want to cut the fat and make it as easy as possible, but we also want to make sure treasurers are not in a place where, at the end of the semester, they say, oh, you know, we asked for too much money, and now what happens?
Yeah, and you know, just, I guess, two reasons why I feel that it would be positive. Not only because I don't think it is burdensome, because they're already expected to do it, rather than, like, a room reservation, which you don't need when you're applying for funding, or how many miles are pulled off, which I think they're supposed to be doing price book beforehand, but also clarifying what the item is for you guys, because you guys are trying to figure out subjectively, you know, is this expenditure what we fund for, what we don't fund for, and having the price quote there does give you a lot more insight into making that decision. And then just the other thing, in this quarter report, you guys are still asking for them in the guidelines, it says you are, but in the PowerPoint, you are.
So the way they'll be asking for those is kind of more in the actual application, in the online system. We kind of found them to be, you know, an extra report is not necessary, so we are going to be asking for groups inventory, but that'll be built into the actual application.
And one last question, quick. You guys changed the definition of a new organization to 2 years not having funding rather than 1 year having funding. So what was the rationale behind that?
It was just the notion of, you know, how kind of the incentive structure we wanted to put in place was that, you know, we wanted financial continuity, we wanted groups to be efficient year in and year out. You know, I know that a lot of the discussion has been around programming, but in order to get the highest level of funding to the groups that do the most programming, we have to be efficient in our funds. You know, if in essence, like, if a group hasn't done anything for that long, then they're starting from scratch, and they should be treated like all other groups starting from scratch.
I think the change was, we were worried if a group is in Tier 1 or Tier 2, and something happens they under the old system. If they didn't apply for a year, they would get automatically placed in Tier 6. So that's why we kind of said, look, maybe 1 year is not enough. Maybe 2 years is a better time to determine what a new group would really be.
I agree with this. Thank you guys for coming across this question.
So we have a couple more minutes left, and we have 2 minutes.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but currently as attended, a group that's based off of consumable items, each individual member has to pay for those items. So, if there's a chocolate club or the tea club, those members have to pay for the chocolate and tea, correct?
If they're consumable, they're not durable.
If, yeah.
Were there any... Did you look into possibly reviewing, because those are the essential operations of those groups? So is there any possible way to create some sort of method where a group that is based off of consumable goods or non-durable goods could apply for funding?
Yeah, so I'm going to point you to section 9.2.3 of the guidelines, specifically line 4 of that. So we added a line to the guidelines under both local events and travel events that accounts for supplies and materials essential to the event. So we're still not going to fund for food or tea, because something like, you know, if you open the door for that, then any group can say, you know, need chocolate at our meetings because we're talking about chocolate this week or whatever. Like, if that's too broad, we don't have enough subjectivity to go into that. But, you know, like Larry's go-to example is there was an organization that did like an Easter egg hunt, and it fell right in line like what they did. They couldn't get eggs because eggs are, you know, a perishable item. So under this, they could argue that it was a supply that was absolutely necessary to the functioning of the event. We're also looking to encompass sports materials in this, like tennis balls, rackets, you know, whatever you can think of. Those would all fall under this new line item that we've created.
Representative
Brown. Hi guys, I just wanted to thank you for your time this semester and this year in general working on this. I think it's a great proposal. Something I wanted to point out was just when you list the criteria for moving to the top tier, I feel like it creates incentives that cannot be met in order for, it'll just raise more issues for you by having some of these criteria such as environmental conservation, accessibility awards and honors. I think just because I think that we have an organization that has gained remarkable honors and awards and master's accessibility environmental conservation aspects, yet has membership of 5 to 10, versus a group with like 500, you could eventually have debate between those organizations. Of course, you're going to prioritize those of the 500 who serve minimal in all areas. You're going to probably give them more funds. So how would you... Would you guys be willing to reword the criteria?
So a lot of time went into the criteria.
Yeah, I was just asking if they can make the criteria
more concrete. So I think it would save them a lot of time in the future with organizations to meet the criteria but don't receive that ability to receive that. So a lot of time went into the criteria, and what we were trying to combat were things that could be manipulated. For instance, membership. If we, you know, listing membership, etc., is something that can be manipulated. Padding membership, you know, going around and collecting a list of 500 names and claiming that 500, you know, people belong to the egg hunting organization, the squirrel club. Apart from that, it's important to say that it's an opportunity for groups to come and essentially, you know, prove to SAFC that they should be eligible for more funding because they are contributing to the Cornell community in a greater aspect. And what we try to do is open the door for as many things as possible and compare them on a level playing field. They don't necessarily have to list, you know, environmental sustainability or necessarily have X amount of awards. It's opportunities for kind of groups to show us what they've accomplished and the direction they're going. They don't necessarily have to fill out every single check mark.
And look, at the end of the day, I'm sure there'll be some decisions that are contentious. Basically, what we want is information points so we can make an informed decision. So you can have an argument as to whether you think organization of 5 to 10 is better than 500, but I think that kind of will be our role to determine that balance. That being said, even if a group doesn't get that tier 1, tier 2 is still a lot of money. And if you look at the difference, it's not about a difference of like $500 to $1,000. It's not the end of the world. Yes, that was one of the cons of the system. We will get more appeals, but I think ultimately us having that discretion will really give us the opportunity to really decide which groups really have the best benefits.
So this is in the guidelines in section 3.1.6.8 in section 10. I know it's like a lot of numbers. And that specifies like the exact, you know, kind of technical aspects of this. And I think like you kind of hit the key when you said a group of like we would probably prioritize the 500 over the 5 to 10, but there's nowhere in certainty that says like one category is more important than the other. I think this fills a much needed void of subjectivity in the SAFC that we've been asking for forever.
Sorry to cut you off, but that's time. Thank you guys so much for coming and presenting. Let's try to get our PR people working together, just upcoming weeks, to get as much feedback on this as possible, and getting everyone in there that will be talking about it and discussing it for potentially passing it next week. Yeah.
I just wonder if all goes well and, you know, we address any outlying concerns, there would be a vote potentially at the end of next week?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's try to get as many different voices at the table starting now.
So, SA members, if you have, like, things that you want to propose amendments for and you don't know how to word it in the guidelines, like, contact me. I can help you figure out, like, the wording for that. And anyone in the community, you know, anyone on SAFC Executive Board would be happy to talk with you guys.
Yeah, just to reiterate, because it is such a complicated issue, I really recommend, you know, trying to meet outside the SA with SAFC exec and with Romeo, or with SAFC exec, you know, as much as possible, because that'll be more productive. And we can have sort of more formalized recommendations for the meeting next week.
identify the alarm clock thing.
Left.
So, do you guys begin
Yeah, so first we're just going to present the friendly amendments that we have to this. First, the new title of SA Resolution 43 is the Student Assembly Recommendations for the New University Calendar. And also that's then the second.
And then the second one is in the line 2 of the Be It Therefore Resolved clause, which is a minimum of 8 full days for the exam period, not 7.
All right, so
So I'll just get this started. Recently, the GPSA passed a resolution that was basically said it was in full support of the University Calendar recommendations. And I think that Natalie and I are less than, we're definitely not that enthusiastic about the changes. So what we want to do is make sure that, first off, the undergraduate student voice is heard in the calendar committee process, making clear what we want, but also have a set of framework, a guideline so that the committee knows what we want and what we think are minimum standards. The things that are in here, the different provisions, aren't what we're necessarily, what Natalie and I want to see happen. It's just things that we think, at a minimum, need to occur. So that's a very important distinction. You know, overall, Natalie and I are very concerned about student mental health. That's the entire focus that we're taking on the calendar. And we think that some of these provisions, things like a minimum 8 days, obviously we think more days is better for mental health. That's how we stand. But we think that that's about the minimum that we could do.
Yeah, and this isn't, I know Jeffrey and I have been saying this is what we think, but this is actually what we've been contacting a lot of different students and student leaders about. We can't really rely on the poll that was from Jay and Dan just because it's not scientifically correct, but the sentiment was very much there that a lot of these changes which we're advocating for should be heard, and we definitely heard that, and we thank them for getting the word out and working with us on that. We also have senior week here. We added in a clause, a minimum of 4 full days for senior week programming because that's when we had our last meeting. That's the minimum they asked for to put on a very productive and robust senior week with everything that's going on. Can I get a couple more seconds? Just the 4 full days for the study period. They were really trying to cut down on study period days if they were going to extend the exam period, but you kind of need both in order to make sure that you have those mental health breaks. So we're curious to hear your thoughts. This also passed in the employee assembly. Both have been passed on to President Gordon, and I'd hate to just send out a cheery we're all united on this front, because I know there's a lot of student sentiment going back and forth on this, so I'd like to get this passed today, and I would like us to not leave until it's passed. So if you have any different concerns, I know I want to hear from everyone in the audience as well. So anything you think about this calendar, please let us know. And if you all in the audience don't have a copy, we have a couple extras upstairs.
So I'm going to open up the speakers list in 1 second just to give people background who may not know about it, especially those who might be in class in 2016. The university teacher over there. The university is, for the first time in about 30 years, re-looking at the academic calendar, and there are a lot of stakeholders involved in this process because it affects so many people on campus. So we're now, as a student government and student assembly on campus, sort of making our recommendations on behalf of the undergraduate student body. And opening up the speakers list, we'll go with
Okay, great.
So the academic break is essentially when classes are off, there are no class. And the basic idea is that there's a lot of student stress, especially in the spring semester. You know, it's cold, it's gray, and there's no break right now in between the start of the semester and spring break. So basically, we're recommending that at some point in there, we're putting in a break. And that's one of the like things that has been pretty much a non-negotiable throughout the entire committee's work, has been that we're going to put some sort of two-day break in between those. The natural break is right now, the exam period would start Wednesday night, you go Thursday, Friday, and then for many students, you have Saturday and Sunday off because there's only one exam period on the Saturday and on the Sunday. However, in the proposed calendar, the most recent revised one, they went Monday to Monday, and they kept Saturday and Sunday as being the one exam period. So basically, you go Monday through Friday, full exams, Saturday and Sunday light exams, and then the final day Monday with exams. And we thought that was kind of dumb. Like, we think that if you're going to have exam period or days that have low exams, only one exam period instead of three, like most days, you should be in the middle of the calendar. So that basically, even if you just have an eight-day calendar that goes Monday to Monday, maybe Thursday and Friday, you have light exams. Most of the students get those off.
Next on the speakers list, and because it's business of the day, you don't have to ask questions solely to make comments. But next on the speakers list is Nicole, Matt, and Lisa from Newly.
To save time, we'll just follow up with questions if you guys have them.
And they find the form stays.
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, friendly.
Perfect.
Next on the speaker list is Representative Scalfo.
Hi. Thank you for coming to the calendar today, people. And of course, thank you. First question about the 4 days for study break. Now, is that included in the new proposal, the most recent proposal?
Yes, in the most recent proposal, we end on a Wednesday, so it would be on a Wednesday, and then you have Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday off, and exams would start Monday, and then exams would run Monday to Monday, so that a week from that Monday would be the last day of full exam. And then senior week would be Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we talk with senior week, and basically they said we need 4 days minimum, so we were trying to change that around a little bit.
And is there still the effort to have senior exams start Monday?
Yes, that's kind of irregardless of like the days themselves, but yes. So we've been working with the university registrar, and a big change that's going to occur is the algorithm that's used. So one of the things that she can do, for example, is she can schedule the exam so that every student is guaranteed to have at least one day off, so you don't have all five of your exams, boom, 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 boom. They're trying to make it so that you have less students will have two exams in one day, less students will have three exams in 24 hours, less students will have two exams on back-to-back days, things like that.
Is there anyone else who wants to be on the first speaker list? Any motions? Yeah. Representative Mueller.
Yeah, I guess I was just, I know that when we talked about this with some administrators, they've kind of suggested to us that we sort of lead with what will be a bring well with faculty and the people who are ultimately making the decision for this. I think it's great that we are highlighting the mental health initiative and well-being persons, but I think that it might be valuable to also mention the fact that, for example, having the Wednesday before Thanksgiving travel for a lot of students and makes it easier and safer for students to get back and forth. And also I would mention that having slope day potentially on a Wednesday, just guessing would make it easier to get artists and actually probably cheaper. So that's another positive to this proposal.
Arts and Sciences Representative Elect Mocho.
Hello, Mocho. Arts and Sciences Elect, whatever. So let's say that there is a minimum of 4 full days study period, and then a minimum of 7 full days per exam period, and then all these, like 1 through 6, are all accepted. And as we talked about earlier, there still needs to be 7, like a certain amount of days that the Cornell has to be in session so that it's considered accredited or whatnot. So if all these days are being cut down, then where exactly are the other days going to be filled up?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think this calendar is basically moving and shifting a lot of days. So we did have a lot of these days built in. We had an extra 2 days for spring break, which we got rid of, and we put it with the fourfold, add an extra day for the senior week programming, add an extra day for study period. But this also leads to the idea of maybe cutting a bit into winter break. I know the faculty senate has brought that up a lot as well. And it seems a bit ridiculous that that's not being considered for just because they don't want their, I guess, faculty concerns. But we thought that that might be a great way, especially hearing from a lot of students saying, why not start a few days earlier in the winter session? We're ready to come back anyways. And we did hear the concerns from IFC and Panhel. But we think that if it's not shortened by an entire week, but maybe a couple of days, it's a great compromise and can definitely work to address all of these points as well.
Thank you.
So that's the end of the speakers list. Are there any questions? The resolution 43 has been called to question, and it's been seconded. Is there any dissent? No. So with that, we're going to have a placard vote. And actually, we'll have a roll call. Chelsea, if you please call the roll.
You got a warning.
Also, just keep in mind, everyone, that there are two amendments that the sponsors made. The first is the name of the resolution, which is Student Assembly recommendations for the new university calendar, and second, prong two of the first meeting, therefore, is a minimum of 8 full days for the exam period. Whenever you're ready, John.
Good. Salek?
Yes.
Block?
Yes.
Breeden?
Yes.
Brown?
Yes.
Chopra?
Yes.
Desai?
Husband.
Francisco?
Yes.
Ross Gitlin?
Yes.
Gorojani?
Yes.
Hoffman?
Yes.
Kay?
Yeah.
Lee?
Yeah.
Miller?
Yes.
Mueller?
Yes.
Nicoletti?
Yes.
Pinckney?
Yes.
Patel?
Yes.
Rapp?
Yes.
Rao?
Yes.
Skelfo?
Yes.
Zolman?
Yes.
Trefison?
Yes.
Wolford?
Yes.
Eterian?
Yes.
So that's 17.
Sorry.
Okay.
That's 20-0-1.
That's by a vote of 20-0-1, resolution 43 passes.
And I'll be seeing you guys when I email President Floyd later today.
Next on the agenda is resolution 41, advocate for the prevention of sexual violence at IFC High School Diversity and Inclusion 101. Jared Brown, Chris Maskin, and Ken Babcock will be in their company.
Sorry, guys. I'm just not feeling well, so I'm just eating lunch.
Also,
players are not appreciated.
Happy birthday to Darren.
So, first off, we have a couple amendments to make. On the first page, Kristen's name is spelled correctly, but in the resolution, it's not. So the second I needs to be an E. And secondly, the third whereas clause, we need to change it to complaints and reports related to the sexual violence against men and women on Cornell's campus. Although wingman is targeted towards men, Nate pointed it out, and great change to the resolution.
Could you just say that again?
Yes, so Kristen's name is spelled incorrectly. It's Ian.
Okay.
And then the third whereas clause, it should be women and men on Cornell's campus.
Okay.
Okay. So Kristen, Ken, and I have been working on this resolution for about a month, a little over a month now. We actually wanted to go out before the April 2nd date, but it was Easter last weekend, and the week before Nina Cummings wanted to just make sure that everything was to her liking. So basically what we're doing is advocating for the prevention of sexual violence in on campus, but specifically in the ISD community through Endorsing Women 101. It has details about what exactly WeMan does. Basically, it's targeted particularly towards men, and it uses the social bystander method so that it really does, the way that it's formatted, it encourages men to think outside the box, and they don't feel as if they're being treated as the criminals in with Consent Ed and other similar educational programs, that tends to be the case. So if you look at the back of the resolution, we have the attached email. It's to be sent to all the ISD chapter presidents. The purposes are laid out in the resolution, but one of the key purposes is just to create somewhat of an awareness now that it's been a week after the April 2nd date that there is an issue with sexual harassment in ISD houses and that this program is here, but just so that ISD presidents do know that it's a major concern. So does anyone have questions?
So this is new business, but it can be brought to someday.
Motion to
move the business. Right, it's been motion to the day. We can vote on it. First is Representative Block.
Hey guys, so obviously this is a great program. Outside of the essay, I'm the head outreach for the Everyone campaign, so you know, we have a very similarly aligned message. The only little thing I want to talk about is just the whereas clause. We're talking about WeMan 101 being the most effective approach towards talking to men. And I don't necessarily know if that's like the message we want to send only because like I think we should try to be as inclusive as possible for like, all efforts to try and reduce sexual assault awareness, and also that like if this is the most effective, then like why would we also implement other ones as well? Does that kind of make sense?
I think we're just saying for men particularly though, mm-hmm. not for students on our campus.
Okay. I mean that was the only thing I wanted to say.
Jared talks about the bystander effort. It's in particular very effective for men because it like changes your everyday interactions, and so it's kind of like a subliminal self-conscious kind of social practice.
Good job, guys.
Thank you for that.
Next one speaker is Representative Mueller.
Hello. So I love Women 101. In fact, when I was in Dartmouth this past weekend, I talked it up to a lot of the chapters that would have anything like this there. But the one thing that I wanted to make sure, I don't see any problem with us as a student assembly endorsing this. And I'm going to actually refer to Melissa for this question because we lost Hannah and Hollis isn't here. But one of the things that has come up when we talk about PU's watchers and possibly having Panhell work out and help us with things is that, as far as I know, Panhellenic it naturally does not agree with bystander intervention programs at all, and they do not support them, and they do not. So I don't know how that factors into us as BSA endorsing it, or how it factors into how you know that interaction. Because obviously it's ISD chapters, but they're usually at events for panel events.
Right. I'm not like challenging that statement, but where did you? We discussed this as a board with Laura Sanders.
Okay, so what came up was we were mentioning how we were talking about funding opportunities for KUB launches, mm-hmm. which is, you know, bystander intervention, alcohol, but also sexual assault and things. Said, you know, maybe Panhellenic National could help pay for it, like Advisory National or something.
Right.
And Hollis said, well, Panhellenic at National does not support bystander intervention programs.
Okay.
Like I said, I don't think that it's an issue for us endorsing it, but I think something that might need to be checked on for...
Yeah, no, that's interesting because our board discussed and endorsed.
think that a way around that might be the fact that this is endorsing it for IFC and not endorsing the same program for panelist women. So maybe that'll be that's the way around it, and that's why it wasn't brought up as an issue in our panelist meeting.
All right, well, something I would be doing.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, before we jump on to our next representative, I just wanted to bring up the fact that it says that the FA encourages, would like to remind you, since being sponsored by IFC as well as Panhellenic and the Wingman program, we want to say that it's from everyone instead of just the student assembly, and that seems a bit removed to me from the issue. Because, yes, we do support it, but it seems like you all are doing a lot of work with it outside of the FA.
Yeah, that would be a great amendment. I think that would be an awesome amendment.
So
I guess motion to amend.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so we'll ask if you want to add that to the email, you can motion to amend it and respond to that. Like
should I do that? Okay, so motion to amend the email so that second sentence, the student assemblies, IFC and the Panhellenic Council. Our Panhellenic Council and Wingman 101 would like to review.
Next on the speaker list is Representative Chopra.
Hi. I think this is a great initiative. I was just wondering, maybe myself and maybe a few others, if you could explain exactly what the Wingman 101 program is and how it evolved.
Yes. So Nina Cumming, she's our special victim advocate here. She's worked with Consent Ed, a lot of these educational programs that are really effective in promoting, making students more aware of what it actually is considered sexual harassment, sexual violence, and how to prevent it. She's been working with Consent Ed and programs and gearing it towards the IFC community, athletic teams, and other large groups of males on campus. And after 10, 15 years, she didn't see any changes in their actual attitudes towards the issue. So she created Wingman 101 with some other individuals at the Gannett Center. She's found it very effective. They're actually doing they're surveying its effectiveness right now with the lacrosse team and other athletic teams on campus. But because it does use the social bystander model, one, and two, the way that they present, they don't really introduce the topic of sexual harassment, sexual assault in the beginning of the presentation, and then at the end it's kind of just like a wake-up call that the topic has been discussed and the issues that they talk about kind of sticks with the males more effectively than women, because women like to discuss sexual harassment, sexual violence, and males don't. So she says she only chooses guys who she feels that can hang. So there's a lot of guys who really, really that's what she used or for can hang. And there's a lot of guys who come to her and would like to get involved in the program, but she kind of makes sure that she feels like they would be comfortable and that other large groups of males would appreciate the material coming from them and really take it all in. So she tends to pick guys already in houses or on athletic teams and such. Right now, the only issue is that there's a limited number of males, so with this, we're also hoping to gain more involvement in Wingman 1 and kind of just to see if there's a larger demand for it than we know of, because there's a potential for funding for it as well, so that the males who participate can get paid in the future.
Okay. And if you'd like to come to the
front
of the table and state your name and
Hi, my name is Zach Elsberger, and I am a full-time staff member in the Student Academic Services and the Student's Office. I'm also the advisor, or one of the advisors I work with Nina for Wingman. As sort of part of my duties. And so I just want to throw out there, if you have questions specifically about the program, I work with the guys, help recruitment and help sort of the facilitation, and so I can answer a lot of the questions about sort of what the program does and how we are a little bit different from sort of other programs that go on either at Cornell or around the country. Thank you. You did a great job. But yes, pretty much it's just a series of scenarios that we walk gentlemen through. And again, we don't really talk about sort of sexual harassment, sexual assault until it gets towards the end. It's just sort of general scenarios that any individual might come across at sort of a, an incident on Cornell campus or off campus as well. And then it's a sort of a wake-up moment for them at the end of, you know, what can be applied, and everyday situations can be applied to, you know, more serious situations. And We really structure it so that they feel that they can discuss anything, and so whatever stays or is mentioned in the room stays in the room. That's why we really try to focus on teams and groups that are, you know, really close to each other because they feel like they can be supportive to each other and say anything they want. And we just sort of structure it so that there is more discussion and sort of lead the through the scenario so people can, you know, sort of get to that aha moment.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So much.
I really
Right, that's the end of our speakers list. Can I have a question?
Yeah, that was an issue that Nina and I discussed, and we actually changed the language a lot so it didn't seem that we were mandating something. It was just a recommendation. But the second main importance of this resolution is that there has been an increase in incidents this year, and by setting this, we're creating more of an awareness that we are on the lookout, kind of, and that sexual harassment is happening. So we are, of course, endorsing Wingman, but it's also just because of that April 2nd period, encouraging the IFC members to become more involved in the social aspects in houses. We want them to know that it's not okay to sexually harass anyone, male or women, who could be in their houses. But if you can think of another suggestion of the best way of doing this, I'd be happy to table it and discuss it with you.
Let's call this to a vote, and if there's another initiative that you think would be just as productive, you can do that as well.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.